Come home and stay a while with Home Place, a podcast about where we're from, where we go, and what these places say about us. Hello, and welcome to Home Place. I'm Anna Richardson White, media producer, communications consultant, and storyteller at heart. This podcast is all about the places that shape us. Growing up in a small town in eastern Kentucky, I knew it was a unique and special place. But then I moved to other cities, and I became fascinated with how every place shapes us. This podcast explores the meaning of home and place from different people's perspectives. I'm so glad you're here. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Home Place. In today's episode, I'm talking to the former governor of West Virginia, Bob Wise. Bob is a dedicated public servant and a champion for education. He served as the 33rd governor of West Virginia from 2001 to 2005, following nearly two decades in the U.S. House of Representatives representing West Virginia. Bob has been a lifelong advocate for improving education nationally. After serving as an elected official, he went on to lead the Alliance for Excellent Education in D.C., where he worked to transform the nation's high schools. His commitment to innovation in education earned him the prestigious Friday Medal from North Carolina State University in 2015. I met Bob serving on the board of the Chartwell School, which is a school for students with learning differences here in Monterey, California. He is such a joy to be around. He always has great stories, as I feel like most people from West Virginia do. And I'm so excited to have him on the show today and to hear more about what home means to him. Welcome, Bob. Hey, Bob. Great to see you.
Good to see you again.
Do people call you governor? I know my husband always calls you governor. Should I be calling you governor?
No, I came in as Bob and I'm going out as Bob.
So.
And that's what I always said when I was in office.
Governor was just a stop along the way.
Yep.
To start from the very beginning, where were you born?
I was born in Washington, D.C.
You were? Interesting. Okay.
My mother had lived in Washington. And interestingly enough, my grandfather in the 1930s, I think it was like 1931 to 1934, had been the head of C&P Telephone Company in Charleston, West Virginia. The C&P network sent him to Charleston, but he was there for 3 years and then moved back to Washington. And people thought, I think that was the last connection they'd have with West Virginia. But then my dad gets a job there and we pick up and move to Charleston. It was a wonderful place to grow up.
So then we do share that in common, our parents not being from there, but then from the place that we grew up. My dad's dad was also born in Paris, Kentucky, but then was raised in Chicago. And so there was always a little bit of a connection to Kentucky, but it was very tangential and it wasn't really the reason my dad at all went back. And I assume your grandfather being there wasn't why your father went, but maybe he had heard enough to know that he could probably live there for a period with his family and everything would be all right.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so tell me how you think about where you're from.
Well, I'm from West Virginia. I was thinking about this sort of two stages to my West Virginia experience. We moved there when I was 5 years old. My father took a job with an insurance company, and we moved to Charleston. Charleston then, as is now, but Charleston then particularly, was the largest city in West Virginia. It was the state capital, but it was also the center for where a lot of the businesses had their headquarters that actually depended upon other parts of West Virginia for their revenue. Particularly, I'm thinking of the coal mining industry and somewhat the banking industry and other natural resources, because West Virginia has several major rivers. That's also where many of the barge companies had their headquarters as well, barging coal up in Ohio and so on. But Charleston, probably like New Orleans is to Louisiana, Louisville maybe to Kentucky, Charleston is the composite of West Virginia, but it doesn't always represent the whole entirety of West Virginia. And I remember the first time when I started working it was during law school. I worked for a year, took a year off and worked with United Mine Workers. And I remember going to a lot of coal mining communities. This is in the 1970s, early 1970s. And when I'd say I was from Charleston, people just looked at me and said, yeah, okay, that's Charleston. And then there's the rest of West Virginia. So in some ways, I spent my first 18 years in Charleston growing up in kind of middle class background. had some knowledge of what was going on around me. But it was only after I came back from college and law school and began working across the state, and particularly in the coal mining communities, that I began to appreciate truly what West Virginia is and who the people are and the incredible resilience and strength and personality. And you and I share that.
Yes, yes. Oh, wow. You've already touched on so many things.
But, you know, I just remember the first time you and I met was in California. And as soon as I heard you speak, I said, I know where this woman's from. We grew up in roughly the same place.
I mean, I couldn't believe that. We should share for folks listening to the podcast that we were part of a board of the Chartwell School, which is a school here in Monterey County where my son goes. I had just joined the board. It was my first meeting and we're at a dinner and you said a few things and I recognized that you were not Californian. But then you just said, where are you from? And I was like, Whitesburg. And you're like, I know Whitesburg, Letcher County. Like you knew exactly. And no one really knows Whitesburg. Some people do know Apple Shop, which is always cool, the organization my parents founded. But for someone just to connect so much like with an accent and a place that's so specific.
I also had some experience in the mid-70s as well, because there was a lot of effort underway in social justice to both try to improve living conditions in many of our mining communities and rural communities, but also to require the natural resource producers, coal mainly, some natural gas, to pay a fair share of taxes and to support education and so on. And so I was involved with Apple Shop, with the Highlander Center in Tennessee, names that have been instrumental in promoting and encouraging and keeping much of the culture of Appalachia.
And you know, I've made this film about my home and about Apple Shop called Apple Heads, and I've taken it to a couple of festivals, and I've met at least one person at each of the festivals who's from West Virginia. There's a diaspora, I feel like, from those mountain communities.
That is a wonderful description, and I've used it before, diaspora.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's been rough. It's a wonderful place to grow up in, but it's also had hard economic times for 100 years. And back in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, there used to be a saying, the three R's, reading, writing, and the road to Akron to make tires, or to Detroit to make automobiles, because that diaspora started in the 50s and 60s. We talk about technology today in the term of supercomputers and computer chips and AI, but the technology in Appalachia that caused a great disruption was when went from pick and shovel and mules in the mines to more sophisticated mining equipment that could actually cut the coal at the face and the miner didn't have to pick at it, so you could produce much more. And then came the 70s and you had the introduction of longwall mining. And longwall mining was moving this giant piece of equipment in that could take out large expanses of coal along, or think of a wall, and it would just move down and take it out. And so what that meant was more and more sophistication was required and less people. And the result was a lot of people being put out of work during the, started in the, really in the 60s and 70s, and has continued to this day.
So when your family moved to Charleston, what year was that?
Probably 1952.
Tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like. You said it was a great place to grow up. What was the vibe in your neighborhood?
Charleston at that time was around 80,000 people in Charleston, Charleston proper, and maybe 250,000 in Kanawha County. Much smaller today. It's under 50,000, I believe, in the city proper. To give you an example, the school system, Kanawha County school system, when I was in high school, was around 65,000 students, and today it's around 26, 27.
Wow.
So you can see that diaspora that I'm talking about taking place, because people are going to be, sometimes, but it's interesting, people will move, but there's always the home place, and they are quick to come back as often as they can, and they retain a lot of their values that they grew up with in West Virginia or Kentucky, or let me just say the Appalachians. And somebody once said to me, and it was so right, once you drink from the headwaters of a West Virginia stream, you will never leave. Mm. And no matter where you go, you're always going to be part of it. And I believe that's incredibly true. There were strong values there. And a lot of the people in Charleston had migrated there from other parts of West Virginia and settled there for businesses, to create businesses, work for the businesses. Charleston was one of the places that you could find jobs that were in the service industry And as also being the state capital, obviously, brought a lot of people in. There were some incredible number of lawyers there. They told me that when I eventually got a law degree and moved back to Charleston, and they told me that when I was first elected to the Congress and I left the practice of law, the Kanawha County Bar wept because I kept the per capita income down to a respectable level. Because I tended to take public interest cases that nobody could pay.
Right. You weren't doing it for the money. You definitely have a history of service. What were the schools like in Charleston when you were coming up?
I thought, well, the schools were good. I mean, once again, and now that differed, it took me a while to recognize there were, I think, 11 high schools at the time. And so George Washington High School, I went to Charleston High School first. And interesting time. It was 1963 to 66. But I went to Charleston High School first, which had 2,500 students in it. And then because it was so overcrowded, they were actually built new high schools to handle the overflow. So then I went to George Washington High School. It was a very, very good school. But it was interesting, Anna, because that was the first time I began to see there was another part of West Virginia. George Washington High School was a consolidation of kids from Charleston, but also kids from Davis Creek.
Which would be out in the county?
Which was out in the county. And that was the old Washington High School. And these kids, I mean, their parents were probably not middle income. They worked hard. They were either working on the state road. They were working, in some cases, at mines, but most of the mining had shut down by that point. These folks had a rougher road to go. And so for the first time, you had not only a culture, but also an economic differences appear. And the kids that were from Charleston were from an area known as South Hills, which tended to be middle income to upper middle income. The kids from Davis Creek were from the creek. And so you had the hill kids, the creek kids. And the best experience I had, though, was as a junior in high school, I got a summer job with a couple of my friends. We got a summer job cutting brush out on Davis Creek for the state highway department. Now, when I say cutting brush, it's not with machines. Those were the old days. It was using a sickle and a scythe, and you took a shovel and you cleaned off you ditched with a shovel, not with a bulldozer. So it was mainly manual labor. But it put me working side by side with the full-time employees, many of whom were working in those days. This was before even food stamps. You got commodities off a truck that would come. They'd drop off commodity cheese, drop off milk and other surplus agricultural products from the federal government. But also, many of the folks had to work for their benefits for a period of time, spend a certain number of hours a week. So we were working side by side with people that were on some sort of welfare assistance. And then also, I was just out in a rural area. It's the first time I ever had to worry about getting into brush with snakes. First time I ever got to jump in a stream in a creek. Almost got fired for that, rightly so.
Well, you were not on a break.
No, the superintendent
was too hot.
The superintendent was a really good guy. He said, if I had been here and seen this, I would have had to fire you. I've only heard about it, so you can keep cutting brush. but what I did learn was I also learned, with respect, I also learned the power at lunch of an RC Cola and a moon pie, stopping at a country store to get something to eat. But that was a great experience and taught me a lot about all of what West Virginia was about, both its challenges, but also its strengths.
It sounds like that was a very humbling summer and probably...
It was. It was incredibly educational and got to learn and see firsthand and experience way a lot of people live.
I can relate to that a bit. My first job in Whitesburg, aside from helping my mom had a restaurant, so I would help out in the restaurant from a pretty young age, help washing dishes. But I was a maid at the Super 8 Motel, which was the nicest motel in our county. And it was me with several women who were much older. They were like, one was, you know, a grandmother to a girl that I was in school with. And I learned a lot about cleaning rooms, making beds. Also,
yeah.
If there was word on the street there was a party at the Super 8 over the weekend, I knew I was going to have to clean that up on Monday, which was never very fun. But yeah, I think it's so great to have those experiences also where you're just connected with people. I don't know about West Virginia, but where I was from in Kentucky, there's not a lot of racial or ethnic diversity, but socioeconomic diversity is also really important to experience. And it sounds like you did that in the summer. I don't know, how diverse was Charleston in terms, was it mostly poor white?
Charleston, you mean ethnically and racially?
Yes.
West Virginia does not have much diversity, but where it does, Charleston's about, was then and is now probably 8 to 10% African-American. It's interesting. The largest percentage of African-Americans, though, was in southern West Virginia in McDowell County, which was the heart of the coal fields. After Charleston, when I was growing up, McDowell County had the largest population, 100,000 people. It's now 24.
Wow.
Because the mines all pretty much are gone. But it was almost 25% African-American.
Mm.
And the reason was because back in the 20s and 30s, the coal companies, the white workers, were beginning to unionize. Then they'd go and look and bring other African-Americans or others in to counter that. And these were people just looking for work. They weren't trying to fight the union movement, but somebody came up to them and said, if you come here, you got a job. And so they went. But, and then a number just came naturally. I remember a friend of mine, I remember him telling me about his father. This was an Italian-American, but his father got off the boat at Ellis Island, and there was somebody holding a sign in Italian, said, you want a job? And the guy said, yeah. And he said, well, get here and we'll take you to the train. And they put him on a train. And 12 hours later, he was in West Virginia in a county mining coal. And so back in the 20s and 30s, I mean, there was a demand for coal miners. And so it drew a lot of people, and people tended, in addition to the whether or not there was a union organizing effort going on, people tend to go where other folks like them have gone. So McDowell County was, or McDowell, as they say, was a center for African Americans. Harrison County was a center for Italian Americans, and so on.
We definitely had that. And some of those stories are not told around the stereotype of Appalachia. Like, the stereotype is not that a quarter of a county would be Black, or that a whole community would be Italian and have Italian traditions in Eastern Kentucky. I think a lot of people think of the Scotch-Irish stereotype of the hillbilly that came as a pioneer, like Davy Crockett. But the point you're making is, like, there was diversity in pockets. But in order to kind of simplify, I think, the stereotype in America, those aren't talked about as much unless you're from there and you kind of know about it.
No, I think absolutely so. I do also want to note, though, in West Virginia, I've left the impression that it's all predominantly coal mining at that time. The coal mining also fed industries that located there. We were very heavy in steel production, for instance, all along the Ohio River, a number of steel mills on both the Ohio side and the West Virginia side. And obviously there was a railroad industry that was there, because not only usually carrying coal, but other commodities and the river traffic. So there was a lot of coal, but the Kanawha River, particularly going to the Ohio, is navigable most of the way. And so you had a lot of lock and dam construction. So that led to other industries locating there, particularly that could be close in the chemical industry. I'm sorry, at one point, Charleston, West Virginia was one of the chemical centers of the world, producing centers of the world, because it was a combination of, it had immediate access to coal for fuel, it had natural gas, which is used in the production of a lot of chemicals, and of course, the river traffic ripped to barge it out, and the rail or rail cars to take it out. So there was a lot of industrial enterprise that went on in West Virginia also.
I do remember always hearing about Charleston as one of the more, like, as a true city, like one of the more kind of cosmopolitan, sophisticated spots within the Appalachian Mountain chain. Because even if you kind of compare it to Louisville, which I get what you're saying, it's not, Louisville is not like the rest of Kentucky, but Louisville also is not Appalachia, whereas, like, you're kind of set in this range, and it really seemed like a hub for industry. And then, you know, culture and affluence, like, comes in part, not to everyone, but so that was an interesting part of your growing up. So then you leave Charleston to go to college in North Carolina.
Yes.
So tell me a bit about that decision.
Well, I mean, my cousin, my sister, had both gone to Duke or were going to Duke. I was fortunate enough and was accepted to Duke, so I just followed them. And
smart.
Yeah, well, and then I graduated from Duke, ended up pretty aimless at that point, bought a Volkswagen van, traveled out. I told you I ran out of gas and money in Monterey, California, so that's how I ended up here 51 years ago. But then went back to college, University of Houston, and to Tulane, finished law school. And at that point, I knew I was going home. And so I went home, took the West Virginia bar, and I knew I could never practice law with a law firm. It was too organized. I'd have to report to people. I didn't do very well that way. So I practiced law on my own, went into an office in Charleston with, there were five other lawyers in there. So we pooled expenses, but we each on our own. But I began taking cases that involved public interest. And I became involved, and this was through Apple Shop and the Highlander Center, particularly. We became involved looking at land ownership in West Virginia, but also across Appalachia, and particularly land ownership, because in Appalachia, it's pretty prevalent. You can have different types of land. Two or three people can own the same plot in different ways. You can have a surface owner. So I own the surface and I can put a house on it. But somebody else has come in and bought the mineral rights, has bought what if there's coal underneath or there's gas underneath. And so in West Virginia, the state constitution says that all properties to be assessed the same. And no one's, and so what in doing an analysis of coal property, a number of us felt that the coal industry was not paying its fair share of property taxes. And 70% of property taxes in West Virginia go to education. So I began filing suits challenging the county assessors to go out and assess at a higher value the coal property, assess it at its real value as opposed to saying it's a much lower value than we could demonstrate. And that was a bit of a long road.
But I assume some folks in the state probably really were supportive of this.
Oh, yeah. No, I was supported by the education community and I was supported by the United Mine Workers, who understood that education was critical for their members and for their young people. And so over time, I worked with AppleRed, which was the Appalachian Research and Defense Fund, which was a legal aid operation in effect. So working with AppleRed, we brought suit and I argued a case in our state Supreme Court on this point, and we won. And so that set a precedent that required them. And I said, okay, Wise, I think I was 30 or 31 years old. You've just won your first case in the state Supreme Court, and this will be there for the ages. Well, wrong. A Supreme Court decision can last until the next legislative session when the folks who lost come to the legislature to try and change the law to read what they want. And that's what got me interested, really involved in elected politics, because I said, we were able to organize, do grassroots organizing and beat it back. But I said, I want to be where the folks are making the law, not where they're deciding it. And so I ended up over time, a couple of years later, running for the legislature, running for the state Senate. I won, surprised everyone, including myself. I won that seat and then went on to Congress. But that's how I got started in politics.
So you felt you could affect more change actually creating the laws than just defending or arguing against one?
Yeah, because the thing about it, and this is not to diminish the role of the courts, because the courts are incredibly important. That court ruling in my favor changed education funding across the state. Mm-hmm. But that court was subject to ruling only on the basis of what the law, how they interpreted the existing law. Somebody changes the law and makes it to read the other way, that court really has no choice.
Right.
And so that's why I wanted to be where the law was being made. I thought that I could be more effective there.
So you kind of breezed through this, but I do think it's an interesting point because currently we're talking and you're in Monterey and I'm over in Carmel Valley. So we're in the same county, but not in the exact same spot. Or you're in Seaside, I guess.
I'm in Seaside.
Right. But when you drove your van across the country and you ran out of gas in Pacific Grove. But then you were like, I knew I was going to go back to West Virginia. And I was curious about that because if you'd walked through another door, you could have ended up just staying in California. Talk a little bit more about that and how you ended up saying, no, right now I need to go back to West Virginia.
I graduated in 1970. So we're at the height of student protest movements. This is the era of civil rights. It's the era of the Vietnam protests. I joined 1,000 others camping out on the Duke Quadrangle for a week, protesting civil rights, but also in behalf of the non-academic employees, the hospital workers, the custodians, and so on, and to earn a higher living wage. So this was an era of activism. And I felt that I knew West Virginia, and that's where I was from, and that's where I wanted to be active. So that was the pull. I will be honest with you. I was able to live in those days. You could actually park your van overnight and live on the beach. I had a job in a local hospital. And so I was able to shower in the morning, eat in the cafeteria, then go to work, and then go back to my place on the beach, which today would be several million dollars of real estate. But if I'd been there maybe six more months, I don't know. That was a pretty strong pull, but I wasn't. And I got accepted into law school and I went back. And so living and doing that, I think I always knew I was going, once I got back into law school, I was always going home because that was where I wanted to use that law degree.
And you felt at that time, you saw the need, I guess, in West Virginia.
There was very much a clear need. And like I say, the battle in that period, some things change and some things don't. But in that period, so much was in transition. Once again, technology in the mines, but also coal was still responsible for generating over 50% of the nation's power. So coal was important. What was happening in the mines was important. What the conditions of workers, not only the pay. I had the very good fortune to go to work when I was kind of an academic nomad for a while. I took breaks off from law school, semester-long breaks. I went switched law school. So during that one of those breaks, I worked for the United Mine Workers in one of their reform and during one of the union elections, and then went back and worked. And when I got out of law school, I went back and worked on Buffalo Creek with the mine workers. The flood had taken place, the famous Buffalo Creek of 1972 killed 122 people, I think, caused by a coal company that had not maintained a refuse dam. The dam burst during rain and flooded down 10 Mile Hollow, maybe longer, and just wiped out entire communities. So 5 years later, there was still a lot of work to be done. And I went back with the mine, supported the United Mine Workers and worked there. I actually got to Hazard, Kentucky one time with the mine workers on an organizing campaign for a weekend when there was a rally. So I was involved in those kinds of issues, organizing issues, starting from even before I came back from law school. Because what I learned was I always saw the law. I knew that I would never be a crackerjack lawyer. I'm pretty good at it. I mean, doing the research and putting together an argument, I'll be frank with you, I think I'm decent at it. But I would never be one that could work for a firm. But what I could do was use the law to organize. And that's why when I got into office, I saw myself as a community organizer. You get elected as a state legislator, they give you some staff. And now you've got the authority to go out and hold mobile offices and to hear what people are saying, bring it back to the legislature, but at the same time, use your position to galvanize people. And it's a mutual process. And when I got to Congress, that was like hog heaven, because there you get a staff of, back then, you got a staff of 18 people. Now, some of them have to be in Washington, but I chose to focus most of them, as many as possible, in West Virginia, in my roughly 20 counties in my district, to focus them in West Virginia, where we could work on community organizing around different issues. So that's how I saw the law and I saw elected office.
And so once you were elected to U.S. Congress, did you live between Charleston still and D.C.?
I had a motto, do not let the Friday sun set on me in Washington. And so I would be always back in Charleston Friday, sometimes Thursday night, if I could cut it. And it's about a six-hour drive or an hour something and a half plane ride, depending on. But I had a district that, particularly in the last years I was in Congress, I was there 18 years, I had a district that was the longest district east of the Mississippi, because it went from literally the banks of the Ohio River in the west, 300 and some miles, to the banks of the Potomac and Shenandoah.
Wow.
In the east. I like to say I was truly bicoastal, but it would take me, I mean, to drive across that district would take, I used to joke, it would take me 10 hours, but I could never drive completely in my district because there's one point it was so narrow that only two deer trail went through one part of it. But I represented, and it was from some of the most urban, because if you know the geography of Washington, D.C., it's expanding outward. So I had bedroom communities of Washington, D.C., and a lot of folks from Northern Virginia that had moved there. And then in the center, I've got what is true West Virginia, and then the Charleston, and then to the banks of the Ohio River. So it was a lot of different settings just in that congressional district, much less when I ran statewide.
Wow, that is fascinating. That does make you wonder how they divide and create those districts.
Well, I had to, when I was redistricted, because we had to change counties every 10 years, when I was redistricted, I had Charleston in the west, and almost 250 to 300 miles to the east was Charlestown. and that, which is only an hour and a half drive from Washington, D.C., those folks in Charlestown don't think they have much in common with Charleston. And my motto was I had to bring Charlestown and Charleston closer together because it was truly very different communities and problems. I mean, one problem is keeping the suburban train running from Charlestown to Washington so that the 700 commuters who work in the federal government can get there every day or work in D.C., and then obviously keeping the steel mills going on the Ohio River and protecting and supporting coal miners wherever they were in many of our rural sections.
So was there a spot in West Virginia when you were in Congress that you just felt a real affinity for?
Well, there are a number. One that I go back to a good deal is Elkins, West Virginia, which is almost in the center of the state. And in some ways, it's a great microcosm because it's one of the largest counties in the country. It's Randolph County. And because it has national forests, I think it's larger than five or six states. So it's huge, and it had mining, it had natural gas production, but it was also somewhat a center, had two small colleges there, Davis and Elkins, and then Alderson brought us up the road. And it was a bit of a challenge because it was somewhat conservative, although Democrat at the time, it was Democrat. It's not no place in West Virginia, I don't think it is today, but that conservative Democrat. And it was interesting because it was the home of Jennings Randolph, who was a United States senator. But Jennings Randolph, who lived through until the 80s and served in the U.S. Senate till the 80s, when I was elected to Congress, he was the only person left from the original New Deal. And he would talk to us about being called in the first 100 days of FDR's administration down to the White House to be lobbied on whatever the piece of New Deal legislation it was. So you had that sense of history coming out of Elkins. Elkins had provided some of the state leadership consistently over time. So the center of the state, microcosm, had a little bit of everything that West Virginia was about. And so, yeah, and some good deer hunting as well. So I did.
And it sounds, yeah, beautiful if there was national forest there too.
No, it is truly beautiful. And railroads through there, beautiful, wonderful river. So
I'll put that on my list to get to at some point.
Well, it has some, I think you'd like it. It has some, they've taken the railroad and developed it into a tourist railroad, can take day trips. You can also, they've got some of the old hotels now converted into modern hotels. So you get a real sense of the history and the flavor of it. And it's an interesting place because Purdue usually had a significant part of the legislative and state leadership in Charleston came from that area of the state.
Interesting. Okay, so then you decide to run for governor. Was it a decision? I mean, because almost in two decades in Congress, were you kind of ready for a change or were you kind of lobbied and pushed at that point by the Democratic Party to throw your hat in the ring?
Oh, nobody lobbied and put nobody lobbied for me. I've got a career of nobody was really urging me to run that was in the party. I've always been kind of the outsider. But what hopefully once I got there, people saw that we could reason together. No, I wanted to run for this reason. I'd been in the Congress 18 years. In the state legislature for two, so 20 years in the legislative process. And I'd worked for the House of Delegates before that. A senior member of Congress told me one time early in my career, I was frustrated. We were on the floor of the House. He said, Bob, you look upset. What's wrong? I said, well, Mr. Chairman, the amendment I'm working on is just not going anywhere. I'm really been a long, long time. And he looked at me and smiled and he said, son, don't come here if you can't handle deferred gratification. And so he was absolutely right. And so I went, look, being in Congress is an amazing privilege. And the people trust you to go to Washington and represent their interests, particularly, and then to understand the interests of 434 other people in the House of Representatives that vote and then the others who don't. So after 18 years, though, I began to feel I want to be someplace where I can have a direct impact. And while it's a privilege to be in the House of Representatives and learning about the concerns of the 330 million people that are in the United States, I'd like to have a direct impact on the 1.8 million that live where I grew up. And so that's why I ran for governor, because as governor, you do have the ability to pick up a telephone and a state agency responds right away. Mm-hmm. And you have the ability to use your office. We once again saw it as a community organizing ability, sometimes organizing to lobby yourself, but you have the ability to use your office to influence so much. And I thought it was critically important to have children's health insurance. And at that point, the Congress, thanks to Senator Rockefeller and from West Virginia largely, the Congress had been involved and passed the Children's Health Insurance Program, which expanded Medicaid, but made it much more easy for kids to be put on. And so as governor, I was able to really push a drive to increase the number of children. I was able to push through a new scholarship program for our universities, the Promise Scholarship Program, but also able to, it seemed like every several weeks I got a crisis. You and I were talking the other day about the recent floods that have hit Kentucky and West Virginia. I think killed 11 in Kentucky, 3 in West Virginia. I mean, these unfortunately are not atypical. And so the ability to immediately be the one that's gathering the resources, overseeing both the search and rescue and then the recovery. We introduced a new program, my administration, where people who were small businesses that have been wiped out, they got an interest-free, or actually they got a forgivable loan. If they went back into business, we loaned them the money.
Wow.
And if they went back into business and they stayed in business 5 years, it was a certain amount was forgiven each year. So because it was far better to put out that $25,000 to them than to have to pay the welfare, unemployment, all the other things that would happen by not putting that business back, lose and lost taxes. So being governor is just an incredible experience because you can have, yes, there are lots of frustrations, but you can have immediate cause and effect. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between, now, legislator, you can write policy that can set for the ages. You have the ability to oversee. That's an important position too, but I was ready for a position where I could have much more direct impact.
So as someone who, you obviously have a lot of energy and passion for service, and you came up during a time where that was a focus, and really you could have probably started, you could have started a life and had a career any place, but you chose to do it in your home state. And then to be governor, I mean, that must have been such a proud moment for you and probably your family. Just to have that opportunity. I feel like I've always thought like the governor of Kentucky had to be one of the coolest jobs.
It is, but I hope my family and others take pride. But I have to tell you, it's also a humbling position because you realize that you are 24/7 and you are the person, particularly in you and I come from, people look to the governor directly. That there's those potholes, that road's in bad shape. That school's run down. My kids aren't doing well. Where do I get health care if that clinic closes down? So governor in my state, and I think governor is important in any state, but it's a more personal position in my state because we're a smaller state, less population, and people look directly to the governor. And I tried to be a governor that was in every part of the state on a regular, and I mean, once every 10 days in your region. You couldn't get away from me. But it's a humbling position because you recognize how much, you recognize the authority you have. More importantly, you recognize how much people are counting on you.
It's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing is, don't forget about elections. Some people say, oh, well, you won that election. I usually won my elections. I did a few of my congressional elections were by larger margins, but every time I'd win a key election, it was by about 51%. And in governorship, it's about 51% of that. Maybe it was a 50 point something. Anyway, just remember when you walk down the street the next day and somebody says hi, you say, one out of two chances that person doesn't want me here. So that keeps you humble too. How do we bridge this gap and be able to work together better? But that was part of what I also believe in. And I believe in today is even more important. If I can find a way, you and I can work together on 25% of the time, we find a project and we can agree on and we work together. We can work together 25% of the time. It gets a lot easier to work together 40%, 50% of the time, because now we're building relationships of trust. We may have disagreements, but we understand and trust each other, and we're working together on common goals. That was always the way I tried to approach it.
Yeah, there's a lot we could talk about on currently what's happening. And I just even listening to the way you speak and your description of like responsibility and humility in a senior leadership role, I think, you know, I'm hoping it's something that we will see more of instead of any less of in the current climate. But I'm curious, where are more people my age in public service and even in running? I think part of what you just touched on, the whole concept of elections and anything that you might have done and your whole family history, like being aired out publicly, really does scare a lot of good people off from serving, I think, today. What would you think?
So I lost my first election for governor when I was 16. And why by that, I mean, I went to Boys State. And Boys State is this week-long program where somebody from each high school goes and you have mock elections for governor and state office. And then you spend the rest of the time in mock legislative sessions. Actually, how do you pass a bill and so on? So I ran for governor and I lost. We go into the hall to make a speech and mine was going to be something banal. I've forgotten what my platform was. But the guy, I still remember, the guy that won had a banner across the hall that said, "Education is the only passport from poverty." Now, this is 1965. He was right then, and he is absolutely correct today. And so I was so impressed, I almost voted, even though I was running. But I always remembered that, obviously. And when I ran for governor, what would that have been, 35 years later, that was my mantra. And so that's how I got started, because he was right. And education then and now, it's the only passport from poverty, and becomes even more important now that we not only learn about how to think and create and do and work, but also how to work together and to be able to coexist with each other in a world that sometimes has developed technologies that can either bring us together or drive us apart. The concept of, I didn't have to worry when I was governor about going viral and saying, if I said something stupid, having it immediately go viral within a minute or two. But it would eventually get to the weeklies, newspapers, and people would pick up on it. But I didn't have to worry about contending with it immediately. I didn't have to be thinking about what my next tweet would be regarding the situation. So, but I just say that I did just want to stress it. I was just so taken in when I was in high school by what this other young man had perceived, that it just stuck with me for the rest of my life. And that's why I've always focused on education wherever I've been.
So then after your time as governor, your next role was specifically focused on, was it high school education?
High school education with the Alliance for Excellent Education, now called All for Ed. But yes, we focused, it was a national organization in Washington, D.C., and we focused on improving high schools across the country.
So then after, did you run for governor a second time? Did you lose?
No.
Okay. So you just did one?
I did one term. I felt that I was a better governor than I was a family man, and I needed West Virginia. There would be people who could, a lot of people who could be governor, but I needed to put things right where I was in my family.
And you have two grown children?
Yes.
Today, yeah. So how old were they when you were governor? Were they teenagers or a little younger?
Yeah, one was entered high school and one left grade school and was in middle school.
And what was that like to have a home in the governor's mansion? So you lived there full time for 4 years? Did you keep you kept a house in Charleston?
Yeah, kept the house in Charleston. I mean, somebody once described another governor in another state, once described being governor and being in a mansion as living above the storm. And that's particularly true in West Virginia. West Virginia, I think, is the only state that actually has the governor's mansion on the Capitol grounds. So I just walked 100 yards and I was at the Capitol. Most of the governor's residences are some distance from the Capitol. But there are clear benefits to it. I mean, kids get some experiences they get to that you wouldn't have. You're also in a fishbowl.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are quick to notice, you're the preacher's kids in some ways. And so you're quick to notice and let you know. We tried not to shield our kids, but we didn't put them out in the public eye. So, I mean, that's about the only way to describe it. I just remember my son, as I say, he was starting high school, I think, when I became governor. But I remember when he was like 4 or 5 when I was in Congress, and we were in a parade, and I always walked in a parade. I clogged in a parade. That's Appalachian dancing. But people seem to like it if they see somebody doing something different. So we were walking in this parade, and it was in a county that I did not do very well in the first couple of times I ran. And he looked at me at 4 years old. He's holding my hand and said, Dad, why is that lady yelling at you so much? And I had to explain to him, son, not everybody agrees with me. And that's just part of this process.
Yes. But that's a good lesson for kids.
Yeah.
Whether you're running, you know, you're an elected official or not. I mean, I'd have that conversation with my kids are 7 and my son's 11 today.
Yeah.
And I just have to say, not everyone's going to like you and not everyone's going to agree with everything that you say or you want to do. But I think to your point, there still needs to be a level of respect. It's a good life lesson. So then you moved to Washington full time at that point when you started your education nonprofit role.
I did. One was couldn't afford 2 mortgages, and the one in Washington and one in Charleston. The other part of it is, I do believe seriously, anytime you've been in a chief executive job or leading something, once you finish, the best thing I think is to get out of town for a while. You've got a successor. That successor is going to do what he or she thinks is best. You may or may not agree with it. Don't be around so that people can ask you how you feel about it. It's their operation now. And so I felt that was true with Congress. I felt that was true with the governorship. I felt that was true when I left after 14 years. And it was a great privilege to be the CEO of All for Ed. So at each time, I've tried to make it a clean break. What I did get to do was I knew I wasn't running for elected office anymore when I left Charleston and went to Washington, but I was very much involved in the advocacy process. In some ways, going back to my roots, because I was running a nonprofit organization that was focused on what mainly at first at the federal level, and then we branched out to state level, what state, federal government and states needed to do to improve education, particularly at the high school level.
So what were some of the big programs that you were able to work on while you were there?
So I take pride in the fact that, and some will dispute this, but I was involved in my organization. We were very early on, second organization actually, to become involved in starting the movement towards the Common Core State Standards, which was pulling states together to develop a set of standards in reading, English language arts, and math, that states would decide whether or not they wanted to adopt, but it would be a higher set of standards than what existed. And ultimately, 48 states adopted them, and then there began to be a backlash about whether this was a federalization of education. It was not. The states did all the work. But even those states that pulled back, they pulled back, but they essentially kept those standards intact. They may call it different names, but they kept intact, as even as one conservative attorney general said, I don't care. Eventually, 2 + 2 does equal 4. And so these standards make sense. So I take pride in being one of the early leaders in the Common Core State Standards. I take pride in the fact that when the U.S. Department of Education was looking for someone to take on something called Future Ready Schools, this was 2010. A wave of technology was being unleashed. All of a sudden, schools began realizing they needed to move to computers and one-to-one tablets for every student. What's the software that's going to be used? What are the systems that will be used? How do we truly improve education? And so they asked different organizations, will they take it on? I agreed. We got no federal funding, but we were able to create something that today has numbers 3,400 school districts and has been working consistently across the country. This was a time when school districts were making, and as they are having to do today with AI, but back then making great decisions, purchasing decisions on what kind of systems they were going to use. Our motto was plan before you purchase, don't purchase, and then plan. And so how do we help districts do the planning that's necessary so that then they do smart purchasing and implementation. So worked on Future Ready Schools, I think was another important initiative. I worked hard on adolescent literacy. We created an adolescent science of learning initiative. And then a lot of the federal, much of the federal policy, we had my organization, because it had an incredible staff. I was very fortunate, the people I was working with. A lot of the federal policy was not generated, supported, and advocated for, and eventually implemented through the Alliance for Excellent Education. We worked closely, and I want to stress this, an organization like AlfRed works closely with other organizations, the Council of Chief State School Officers, that's state superintendents. So the organizations of different government officials, Governors Association, state superintendents, and so on, but then other organizations of similar and like mind. And that's why the literacy movement that you and I are involved in and Chartwell School is involved in is so important. But I always saw, working for AlfRed, I always saw myself as I wasn't casting a vote anymore. I was helping put it together for the people that did cast the votes. And I think that's an important role.
Oh, it's so interesting. You've worked in so many different points along the chain to make change, you know?
No, it's funny you say that, because when I was in office, I focused on early childhood, and my administration signed and then kept the funding for one of the first universal four-year-old programs in the country. So I worked on early childhood, and I worked on college access. And as I mentioned, it's a promise scholarship, other things. Then I got to the Alliance for Excellent Education, and I realized that I worked on the bookends, early childhood, college access. I missed the middle. And so then, and now what I've focused on is sort of that missing middle, K-12, the in between early childhood and college. The Alliance let me work on our high schools. And when you work in high schools, then you're also looking at what it is, how it is the kids are prepared coming into high school. That helped me fill in.
That makes a lot of sense then with the work that we've been doing at Chartwell, and you've been part of it much longer. Yeah, I totally agree with education being the passport out of poverty. I have seen that firsthand. My dad would always tell me, you know, education is the one thing. Like, we will figure out how to pay for an education for you, because no one can take that away from you. And wherever you go, it's going to help you if you learn how, you know, just reading at the beginning, and then critical thinking and how to communicate well with others. And it's interesting having a son who has learning differences and has a very different learning style and just a different personality around school. Like, he wants to learn, but he doesn't love learning in a traditional school setting, which is why Chartwell is great for him. But yeah, Chartwell is still a school. He would much rather go literally sell stuff door to door in the neighborhood than sit through another math class. But we constantly have the conversation, okay, well, you have to learn the basics of X, Y, and Z so that you can go start your business. But it is interesting to think about how school is going to be, and how just education is changing, and how it'll be different, I think, even when he, in the next 10 years or so.
What your son is, I think, saying he wants is experiential education. He will learn by doing. And yes, there's a certain amount that you just have to sit down and learn, but how are we able to put together the program so that he's learning by doing different projects that in turn say, okay, now I have to do math over here. So I just think this is such a critical time for education and for being willing to work with one another. I also think this, I am trying to be optimistic, and I believe that besides being nonpartisan, education is one of the few areas where we can truly work together. I've been involved in a project with the Hunt Institute, which works with states, and focused on what they call across the aisle work, actually doing polling and surveying of public opinion to show opinion leaders that the public has clear education priorities of literacy, mental health, career-ready skills, developing career-ready skills, and safe schools. And that's, and the second part that's most important out of that work is the public sees this not as bipartisan, as nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. Because it's 80% plus for Democrats and Republicans on these issues. So therefore, let's not focus as much on the red meat issues, focus on what needs to be done. That becomes critically important right now, because we've just come out of COVID, and COVID incidentally had the single greatest expenditure infusion of federal dollars in education ever. That money, and then now the deadlines have passed for spending it. So we've just come out of COVID. We just had a massive expenditure of dollars. And now we're facing budget challenges. And so this is a time when we truly have to be looking at how we're going to change education to be relevant to your son and to a lot of others. And then maybe through that process, we learn to work together on some other issues in a very polarized country. But education can be one of those areas where we truly work together.
I love hearing you say that. I agree. And I feel optimistic, especially with some of the stats you just shared. Okay, so Bob, we are at the end of our time. I don't want to keep you too long, but I was curious. I have two last questions about home for you. One, where would you say your home is now?
It's interesting. My home floats. I mean, Washington, D.C., my family, my kids, but also I feel so strongly about the Monterey and Monterey Peninsula. I've been here for 51 years in some form. But the important thing is California is on the cutting edge of everything. It's got the cutting edge of progress and also in education. It's also on the cutting edge of the problems. So you can see every extreme in California and the chance to influence literacy here, but that will have an impact across the country. So, I mean, but I got to tell you, I go to Facebook and I look at some of the, like every community, there are a couple of people that post pictures of Charleston and West Virginia. And I drank from that West Virginia stream. I'm not leaving. Can't leave. That's why I've enjoyed talking with you. I watched your film and I kind of got tears because it's home.
Oh, I love that. Well, I am going to be showing my film in a couple of spots in West Virginia at the Mountain Crafts, which is a film festival in Morgantown, and then also the Appalachian Film Festival. I'll send you the info. If you're in DC, you can come. I'm definitely going to, in Mountain Craft, we're going to do a retrospective on Apple Shop and show a few films there, and that'll be in October.
Well, there's some folks in Charleston, as you and I talked about, who supported Apple Shop and were involved in it from way back in the day when your folks were starting it.
Yeah, I love that. That's such a great connection. Okay, so my final question is, if you could call one place home that you've never lived in before, you know, the end comes, Bob, where would that place be?
Oh, God. I mean, to me, I'm just excited by so many different places in this country, some of which I haven't seen and in the world. So I can't, it's really hard for me to say. I'd like to just be, I'll tell you what I'd like for my home. If I have a choice, I want my home to be the equivalent of the Volkswagen van that I traveled around in 1971, because that would, I think I want an update. I think I want a little more powerful engine, and I want cup holders and stuff, and maybe air conditioning. But just the ability to travel and to see and meet people, that to me is home. And of course, but also being connected to those I love.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. Have you seen the new electric VW?
Saw an ad for it the other day.
You did? Oh, it's probably following you around on the internet. You'll probably see more now. That would be cool. I could see you, you know, getting one of those and doing like national parks tour one summer.
If the national parks, I've forgotten, I think that's an all EV. The national parks have to have good charging stations. And I'll tell you, when I was camping, parked on the Asilomar, that's the state beach, of course, in off of Monterey, where I would camp during back in 1971, I didn't notice any electrical outlets out there. So
that may have changed, but maybe not in the national parks yet. Oh, well, Bob, this was lovely. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing so many great stories with me and, you know, piece of history from our part of the world. It's really, really cool.
Well, thank you for having the chance to talk about a place we both love and that created us and produced us and a whole lot of other fine people, too.
So well said. Thank you. That's it for this episode of Home Place. Thank you for spending time with me today. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and share it with someone else you think might enjoy it. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, take care and keep finding meaning in the places that matter most.